Greetings, listeners. We're back once again to talk to you about the Cthulhu mythos, its books, its monsters, its unfortunate human casualties, its timeline in general, and even its tangential bits like the dreamlands, or things of a weird nature, or things that are Lovecraftian leaning. Weird fiction, science fiction, horror, learn of terrible meetings in lonely places, of cyclopean ruins and vast staircases that lead down to abysses of nighted secrets, of complex angles that lead through invisible walls to other regions of space and time, and of hideous explorations in remote and forbidden places, on other worlds, and in different time-space continua. From the creation of our galaxy to the death of the sun, this is an exploration of the Cthulhu mythos from the perspective of humans' concept of history. We are the people's guide to the Cthulhu mythos. You can find us at pgttcm.com, pgttcm.podbean.com, and you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. The people's guide to the Cthulhu mythos starts now.
The People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos. Season 8.
Greetings and welcome to The People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos. I am your host, D.B. Spitzer. And between episodes, let's see, 107 and 134, we will be talking about The Beetle. The Beetle, a Mystery, is a 1897 horror novel by British writer Richard Marsh. To tell you about it is to spoil it. So check it out, and that'll be going on from now until sometime in December. This episode is brought to you by FoundOutOnClothing.com and BunnySlippers.com. Subscribe to PGTTCM with D.B. Spitzer and Seraphie. Wherever you subscribe to podcasts, we prefer Podbean and Apple Podcasts. Check out the new website over at pgttcm.com and check out the merch table over at pgttcm.threadless.com. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at pgttcm, or check us out on YouTube at People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos, edited by Daniel Spitzer. Music by Kevin MacLeod, featuring The Hive, Ghost Story, Ghost Processional, Oppressive Gloom, and our theme song, The Chamber.
Chapter 33. What came of looking through a lattice? He began in accents which halted not a little. By degrees, his voice grew firmer. Words came from him with greater fluency. I am not yet 40, so when I tell you that 20 years ago I was able to speak transpired. I lost both my parents when I was quite a lad, and by their death, I was left in a position in which I was, to an unusual extent, in one so young, my own master. I was ever of a rambling turn of mind, and when at the mature age of 18 I left school, I decided that I should learn more from travel than from sojourn at a university. So, since there was no one to say me nay, instead of going either to Oxford or Cambridge, I went abroad. After a few months, I found myself in Egypt. I was down with fever at Shepherd's Hotel in Cairo. I had caught it by drinking polluted water during an excursion with some Bedouins to Palmyra. When the fever had left me, I went out one night into the town in search of amusement. I went unaccompanied into the native quarter. Not a wise thing to do, especially at night, but at 18 one is not always wise, and I was weary of the monotony of the sick room, and eager for something which had in it a spice of adventure. I found myself in a street which I have reason to believe is no longer existing. It had a French name and was called the Rue de Rabagas. I saw the name on the corner as I turned into it, and it has left an impress on the tablets of my memory which is never likely to be obliterated. It was a narrow street and, of course, a dirty one, ill-lit and apparently, at the moment of my appearance, deserted. I had gone down, perhaps halfway down its torturous length, blundering more than once into the kennel, wondering what fantastic whim had brought me into such unsavory quarters, and what would happen to me if, as seemed extremely possible, I lost my way. On a sudden, my ears were saluted by sounds which proceeded from a house which I was passing. Sounds of music and of singing. I paused. I stood a while to listen. There was an open window on my right, which was screened by latticed blinds. From the room which was behind these blinds, the sounds were coming. Someone was singing, accompanied by an instrument resembling a guitar, singing uncommonly well. Mr. Lessingham stopped. A stream of recollection seemed to come flooding over him. A dreamy look came into his eyes. I remember it all as clearly as if it were yesterday. How it all comes back. The dirty street, the evil smells, the imperfect light, the girl's voice filling all at once the air. It was a girl's voice, full and round and sweet, an organ seldom met with, especially in such a place as that. She sang a little chansonette, which just then half Europe was humming. It occurred in an opera which they were acting at one of the boulevard theaters, La Petite Voyageuse. The effect, coming so unexpectedly, was startling. I stood and heard her to an end. Inspired by I know not what impulse of curiosity, when the song was finished, I moved one of the lattice blinds a little aside so as to enable me to get a glimpse of the singer. I found myself looking into what seemed to be a sort of café, one of those places which were found all over the continent, in which women sing in order to attract custom. There was a low platform at one end of the room, and on it were seated three women. One of them had evidently just been accompanying her own song. She still had an instrument of music in her hands and was striking a few idle notes. The other two had been acting as audience. They were attired in the fantastic apparel which the women who are found in such places generally wear. An old woman was sitting knitting in a corner, whom I took to be the inevitable patron. With the exception of these four, the place was empty. They must have heard me touch the lattice or seen it moving, for no sooner did I glance within than the three pairs of eyes on the platform were raised and fixed on mine. The old woman in the corner alone showed no consciousness of my neighborhood. We eyed one another in silence for a second or two. Then the girl with the harp, the instrument she was manipulating proved to be fashioned more like a harp than a guitar, called out to me. Entrez, monsieur. Soyez le bienvenu. I was a little tired, rather curious as to whereabouts I was. The place struck me, even at that first momentary glimpse, as hardly in the ordinary line of that kind of thing. And not unwilling to listen to a repetition of the former song, or to another sung by the same singer. On condition, I replied, that you sing me another song. Ah, monsieur, with the greatest pleasure in the world, I will sing you 20. She was almost, if not quite, as good as her word. She entertained me with song after song. I may safely say that I have seldom, if ever, heard melody more enchanting. All languages seemed to be the same to her. She sang in French and Italian, German and English, in tongues with which I was unfamiliar. It was in these Eastern harmonies that she was most successful. They were indescribably weird and thrilling, and she delivered them with a verve and sweetness which was amazing. I sat at one of the little tables with which the room was dotted, listening entranced. Time passed more rapidly than I supposed. While she sang, I sipped the liqueur with which the old woman had supplied me. So enthralled was I by the display of the girl's astonishing gifts that I did not notice what it was I was drinking. Looking back, I can only surmise that it was some poisonous concoction of the creature's own. That one small glass had on me the strangest effect. I was still weak from the fever, which I had only just succeeded in shaking off, and that, no doubt, had something to do with the result. But, as I continued to sit, I was conscious that I was sinking into a lethargic condition, against which I was incapable of struggling. After a while, the original performer ceased her efforts, and her companions taking her place, she came and joined me at the little table. Looking at my watch, I was surprised to perceive the lateness of the hour. I rose to leave. She caught me by the wrist. "Do not go," she said. She spoke English of a sort and with the queerest accent. "All is well with you. Rest a while. You will smile. I should smile, perhaps, were I the listener instead of you. But it is the simple truth that her touch had on me what I can only describe as a magnetic influence. As her fingers closed upon my wrist, I felt as powerless in her grasp as if she held me with bands of steel. What seemed an invitation was virtually a command. I had to say whether I would or wouldn't. She called for more liquor, and at what again was really her command, I drank of it. I did not think that after she touched my wrist, I uttered a word. She did all the talking, and while she talked, she kept her eyes fixed on my face. Those eyes of hers, they were devils. I can positively affirm that they had on me a diabolical effect. They robbed me of my consciousness, of my power of volition, of my capacity to think. They made me as wax in her hands. My last recollection of that fatal night is of her sitting in front of me, bending over the table, stroking my wrist with her extended fingers, staring at me with her awful eyes. After that, a curtain seems to descend. There comes a period of oblivion. Mr. Lessingham ceased. His manner was calm and self-contained enough, but in spite of that, I could see that the mere recollection of the things which he told me moved his nature to its foundations. There was eloquence in the drawn lines about his mouth and in the strained expression of his eyes. So far, his tale was sufficiently commonplace. Places such as the one which he described abound in the Cairo of today, and many are the Englishmen who have entered them to their exceeding bitter cost. With that keen intuition which has done him yeoman's service in the political arena, Mr. Lessingham at once perceived the direction my thoughts were taking. You've heard this tale before? No doubt, and often. The traps are many, and the fools and the unwary are not a few. The singularity of my experience is still to come. You must forgive me if I seem to stumble in the telling. I am anxious to present my case as baldly and with as little appearance of exaggeration as possible. I say with as little appearance, for some appearance of exaggeration appears unavoidable. My case is so unique, and so out of the common run of our everyday experience, that the plainest possible statement must smack of the sensational. As I fancy you have guessed, when understanding returned to me, I found myself in an apartment with which I was unfamiliar. I was lying, undressed, on a heap of rugs in a corner of a low-pitched room which was furnished in a fashion which, when I grasped the details, filled me with amazement. By my side knelt the woman of the songs. Leaning over, she wooed my mouth with kisses. I cannot describe to you the sense of horror and of loathing with which the contact of her lips oppressed me. There was about her something so unnatural, so inhuman, that I believe even then I could have destroyed her with as little sense of moral turpitude as if she had been some noxious insect. "Where am I?" I exclaimed. "You are with the children of Isis," she replied. What she meant I did not know, and do not to this hour. "You are in the hands of the great goddess, of the mother of men." "How did I come here?" "By the loving kindness of the great mother." I do not, of course, pretend to give you the exact text of her words, but they were to that effect. Half raising myself on the heap of rugs, I gazed about me, and was astounded at what I saw. The place in which I was, though the reverse of lofty, was of considerable size. I could not conceive whereabouts it could be. The walls and roof were of bare stone, as though the whole had been hewed out of the solid rock. It seemed to be some sort of temple, and was redolent with the most extraordinary odor. An altar stood about the center, fashioned out of a single block of stone. On it a fire burned with a faint blue flame. The fumes which rose from it were, no doubt, chiefly responsible for the prevailing perfumes. Behind it was a huge bronze figure, more than life-size. It was in a sitting posture and represented a woman. Although it resembled no portrayal of her I have seen either before or since, I came afterwards to understand it was meant for Isis. On the idol's brow was poised a beetle. That the creature was alive seemed clear, for as I looked at it, it opened and shut its wings. If the one on the forehead of the goddess was the only live beetle which the place contained, it was not the only representation. It was modeled in the solid stone of the roof and depicted in flaming colors on hangings which here and there were hung against the walls. Wherever the eye turned, it rested on a scarab. The effect was bewildering. It was as though one saw things through the distorted glamour of a nightmare. I asked myself if I were not still dreaming, if my appearance of consciousness were not after all a mere delusion, if I had really regained my senses. And here, Mr. Champnell, I wish to point out, and to emphasize the fact that I am not prepared to positively affirm what portion of my adventures in that extraordinary and horrible place was actuality, and what the product of a feverish imagination. Had I been persuaded that all I thought I saw I really did see, I should have opened my lips long ago, let the consequences to myself have been what they might. But there's the crux. The happenings were of such an incredible character, and my condition was such an abnormal one, I was never really myself from the first moment to the last, that I have hesitated, and still do hesitate, to assert where, precisely, fiction ended and fact began. With some misty notion of testing my actual condition, I endeavored to get off the heap of rugs on which I reclined. As I did so, the woman at my side laid her hand against my chest lightly. But, had her gentle pressure been the equivalent of a ton of iron, it could not have been more effectual. I collapsed, sank back upon the rugs, and lay there panting for breath, wondering if I had crossed the borderline which divides madness from sanity. "Let me get up, let me go," I gasped. "Nay," she murmured, "stay with me yet a while, O my beloved." And again she kissed me. Once more Mr. Lessingham paused. An involuntary shudder went all over him. In spite of the evidently great effort which he was making to retain his self-control, his features were contorted by an anguished spasm. For some seconds, he seemed at loss to find words to enable him to continue. When he did go on, his voice was harsh and strained. "I am altogether incapable of even hinting to you the nauseous nature of that woman's kisses. They filled me with an indescribable repulsion. I look back at them with a feeling of physical, mental, and moral horror. Across an interval of 20 years, the most dreadful part of it was that I was wholly incapable of offering even the faintest resistance to her caresses. I lay there like a log. She did with me as she would, and in dumb agony I endured." He took his handkerchief from his pocket, and although the day was cool, with it he wiped the perspiration from his brow. To dwell in detail on what occurred during my involuntary sojourn in that fearful place is beyond my power. I cannot even venture to attempt it. The attempt, were it made, would be futile and, to me, painful beyond measure. I seem to have seen all that happened as in a glass darkly, with about it all an element of unreality. As I have already remarked, the things which reveal themselves, dimly, to my perception, seem too bizarre, too hideous to be true. It was only afterwards, when I was in a position to compare dates, that I was enabled to determine what had been the length of my imprisonment. It appears that I was in that horrible den more than 2 months, two unspeakable months. And the whole time there were comings and goings. A phantasmagoric array of eerie figures continually passed to and fro before my hazy eyes. What I judged to have been religious services took place, in which the altar, the bronze image, and the beetle on its brow figured largely. Not only were they conducted with a bewildering confusion of mysterious rites, but, if my memory is in the least degree trustworthy, they were orgies of nameless horrors. I seem to have seen things take place at them at the mere thought of which the brain reels and trembles. Indeed, it is in connection with the cult of the obscene deity to whom these wretched creatures paid their scandalous vows that my most awful memories seem to have been associated. It may have been, I hope it was, a mirage born of my half-delirious state, but it seemed to me that they offered human sacrifices. When Mr. Lessingham said this, I pricked up my ears. For reasons of my own, which will immediately transpire, I had been wondering if he would make any reference to a human sacrifice. He noted my display of interest, but misapprehended the cause. "I see you start. I do not wonder, but I repeat that, unless I was the victim of some extraordinary species of double sight, in which case the whole business would resolve itself into the fabric of a dream, and I should indeed thank God, I saw, on more than one occasion, a human sacrifice offered on that stone altar, presumably to the grim image which looked down on it. And, unless I err, in each case the sacrificial object was a woman, stripped to the skin, as white as you or I. And before they burned her, they subjected her to a variety of outrage of which even the minds of demons could conceive. More than once since then, I have seemed to hear the shrieks of the victims ringing through the air, mingled with the triumphant cries of her frenzied murderers and the music of their harps." It was the cumulative horrors of such a scene which gave me the strength, or the courage, or the madness, I know not which it was, to burst the bonds which bound me, and which, even in the bursting, made of me, even to this hour, a haunted man. There had been a sacrifice, unless, as I have repeatedly observed, the whole was nothing but a dream. A woman, a young and lovely Englishwoman, if I could believe the evidence of my own eyes, had been outraged and burnt alive while I lay there helpless looking on. The business was concluded. The ashes of the victim had been consumed by the participants. The worshippers had departed. I was left alone with the woman of the songs, who apparently acted as the guardian of that worse than slaughterhouse. She was, as usual after such an orgy, rather a devil than a human being, drunk with an insensate frenzy, delirious with inhuman longings. As she approached to offer me her loathed caresses, I was on a sudden conscious of something which I had not felt before when in her company. It was as though something had slipped away from me, some weight which had oppressed me, some bond by which I had been bound. I was aroused, all at once, to a sense of freedom, to a knowledge that the blood which coursed through my veins was, after all, my own, that I was master of my own honor. I can only suppose that through all those weeks she had kept me there in a state of mesmeric stupor, that, taking advantage of the weakness which the fever had left behind, by the exercise of her diabolical arts, she had not allowed me to pass out of a condition of hypnotic trance. Now, for some reason, the cord was loosened. Possibly her absorption in her religious duties had caused her to forget to tighten it. Anyhow, as she approached a man, and one who, for the first time in many a day, was his own man. She herself seemed wholly unconscious of anything of the kind. As she drew nearer to me, and nearer, she appeared to be entirely oblivious to the fact that I was anything but the fibreless, emasculated creature which, up to that moment, she had made of me. But she knew it when she touched me, when she stooped to press her lips to mine. At that instant, the accumulating rage which had been smoldering in my breast through all those leaden, torturing hours sprang into flame. Leaping off my couch of rugs, I flung my hands about her throat, and then she knew I was awake. Then she strove to tighten the cord which she had suffered to become unduly loose. Her baleful eyes were fixed on mine. I knew she was putting out her utmost force to trick me of my manhood. But I fought with her like one possessed, and I conquered in a fashion. I compressed her throat with my two hands as with an iron vice. I knew that I was struggling for more than life, that the odds were all against me, that I was staking my all upon the casting of a die. I struck at nothing which could make me victor. Tighter and tighter my pressure grew. I did not stay to think if I was killing her, till on a sudden, Mr. Lessingham stopped. He stared with fixed glassy eyes as if the whole was being reenacted in front of him. His voice faltered. I thought it would break down, but with an effort he continued. On a sudden I felt her slipping from between my fingers. Without the slightest warning, in an instant she had vanished. And where, not a moment before, she herself had been, I found myself confronting a monstrous beetle, a huge writhing creation of some wild nightmare. At first the creature stood as high as I did, but as I stared at it, in stupefied amazement, as you may easily imagine, the thing dwindled while I gazed. I did not stop to see how far the process of dwindling continued. A stark raving madman for the nonce, I fled as if all the fiends in hell were at my heels. End of chapter 32.